This is the Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo, giving you the inside track on all the big talking points from Goodison Park.
Hello and welcome to the Royal Blue Podcast. I'm your host, Ian Kroll, and today I'm joined by the Echo's Everton FC reporter, Joe Thomas. Joe, how are things?
Nervous, because off the camera you just told me about you're going to put me on the spot, so I'm apprehensive now.
Don't be nervous. It's a good question, and I'm going to come on to why. I'm going to put you on the spot. We're also joined by Gav Buckland, regular Royal Blue contributor, ESC statistician. Gav, how are things?
I'm nervous because Joe's nervous.
Just a nervousness all around.
Yeah.
Okay, well, don't be nervous, guys, because I'm going to come on to why. I'm going to put you on the spot, but like I say, it's a good question. So for those listening, for those watching live on YouTube and Facebook, we are going to talk about the takeover and we're going to talk about the Manchester United game tomorrow. So preview, build up to that. But before we do, I just want to address a little bit of feedback, guys, on the pod that we did last week. I'm going to describe it as the Double Jeopardy podcast.
Okay.
We had a lot of feedback, didn't we? Comments,
yeah.
Good and bad. Joe, just your thoughts. I would say good and bad, but your thoughts on the feedback that we got from that podcast.
Well, all feedback's welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, good, bad, and constructive. And I think that's really important. That's something that we really, really want to keep coming in because, yeah, obviously we've been doing these podcasts for quite a while, but I think everyone can see that we're just trying to expand and be a little bit more ambitious with them and do a few more and try and keep the content coming. We can see there's an appetite for it, and the more input we get from the people that are at least giving us the time to look at us once, then the more that hopefully we can learn from it and improve what we're doing. So that's certainly good. And I was actually relatively pleased with the feedback. Look, I mean, yeah, it was a difficult discussion that we had last week. You know, we laid out some of the truths around the position with Everton and the Premier League and prop and sustainability. And the reality is that it doesn't make for good reading for Everton. And yeah, there are, I think all three of us agree with a lot of people inside and around the club and football in general, that the Premier League haven't handled this process very well and that its processes may not be fit for purpose. But I think it'd be a dereliction of duty if us, given our position as journalists, weren't to make it clear that, you know, this is a difficult situation that Everton have put themselves in largely, and, you know, they are facing the consequences from, you know, poor decisions over a sustained period of time, and that is part of the backdrop to this.
Gav, your Twitter was quite active over the past week, I noticed.
Getting called dour, which is probably right, by the way. I'm miserable, but that's 52 years of being an Everton fan, does that see you, I think. No, I go totally with Joe there. I think, you know, it's quite an emotional time, isn't it, to be an Everton supporter, and emotions are running quite high, understandably. And I think any feedback is positive. And to be fair, you said good and bad. Most of the feedback I saw was good.
Yeah.
And I think that was, you know, to the credit of everybody. I think people now realise that what they want is a balanced view. Is to, you know, and like I get in the early days of the PSR stuff, you know, the accusation about the Premier League and stuff like that. But ultimately, you've got to judge what the commission said and what the appeal said. About, so that's two different parties said about what's happened to Everton, and I think we've always given a balanced view. Yeah. Certainly when I've been on this podcast of matters, whilst at the same time also holding the Premier League to account over some of their activities during that period, and I hope that continues. Hope it sounds terrible thing to say. Hope to, you know, for this second commission that, you know, that will carry on, and I think that's where supporters are now. They want a realistic view of things, and then that's to their credit, and I don't mind getting stick on there, I think all feedback's positive, and they are, let's face it, Everton's not being filled with paroxysms of joy over the last few years, have they? You've got to reflect the environment in which the club's operating on, and I think we've done that pretty well.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was, I wouldn't say difficult podcast to do, you know, you guys were really good at relaying the information as what you knew, but I just, you know, found a nice little debate going, you know, me asking the questions from some of the guys and the women that were, you know, sending in their comments. And, you know, that's what it's about, certainly. That's why we go live now. You know, it's a fantastic way to interact with the viewers and the listeners. And, you know, as Joe mentioned, we're looking to expand on that, and we're gonna continue to do that. So, you know, putting you on the spot, as I mentioned previously, we've been described, I think you described it, or someone described it as dour.
Yeah, that was me.
A bit gloomy. Yeah, so yeah. We probably have been a little bit gloomy and dour, haven't we, over the past couple of weeks? You know, there's reasons for that. So what I want people to do in the comments, we're playing United this week, Saturday. I just want people to be positive and tell us the best, most memorable Everton goal against United. Get your comments in and tell us now, and then I'll read them out. I'll read your name out. And obviously, this is where I'm going to come to you guys.
Yeah.
But you're on the spot. Your nerves can go now. All I'm going to ask you is, Joe, your best, most memorable Everton goal against United?
Duncan Ferguson's header.
Okay.
Yeah, in the 1-0, first time I've ever been to Goodison Park. Was it at 90?
I was going to say, which one? The 95 one or the 2005
one? 95, that one. Like, yeah, just remember. God, it must have been about, what, 6 or 7 at the time. First time I've ever been to a Premier League ground. And, yeah, just stopped.
So that was your first ever Everton game?
First ever Everton game, that was it.
Wow, what a time to go.
Yeah, so obviously, yeah, certainly when it's Manchester United at Goodison Park, yeah, that brings back some good memories for me.
Gav, you probably have a lot to...
I have. Can I say two? One old school and one very new school. Is I'm going to go with most memorable. There was a memorable goal. It was just when we beat United 5-0, October 1984, one of the great Everton performances. It was the fifth goal. I think it was headed by Graeme Sharp. And the simple reason for that is a 4-0 win in football, it's sort of in the sort of, you know, it's about normal, isn't it? It's the very edge of normal, but 5-0 is a thrashing, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's a big difference in football between 4-0 and 5-0. And for that reason alone, I've always remembered that goal because I think 5-0 reflected our domination on the day. I think the other one I would mention, and as picking up on Joe's point, is that it just symbolises everything about Goodison. On the lights, big occasion was Duncan Ferguson's goal in 2005 against United, the header. That is Goodison on the lights. I think just before the free kick, I think Arteta took the free kick and he said, Martin Tyler on commentary said, the atmosphere is amazing. What will it be like if Everton score? And Ferguson scored about 5 seconds later and then he heard it was an amazing atmosphere. And I think that goal captured everything about Goodison on the lights. And it was something that we will miss, but in that moment, it was just a fantastic goal.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? And that probably was going to be my one, but I've come up with a backup for my one. So, unfortunately, this didn't result in an Everton win, but it was just so surprising and shocking that we managed to get a result from it. Mikel Arteta's one, the 3-3 comeback at Goodison Park.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
I think we were either 3-0 down or 3-1 down at some point, and we scored two very late goals. And I just remember, quite a few people had left the ground already, and then we got a goal to make a 3-2, and then someone in the lower Gladys just shouted as a joke, because it was like literally 30 seconds left, believe. Yeah. As a joke, and everyone laughed, and then Mikel Arteta scored, and it was just absolute scene.
3-1 going into injury time, wasn't it? And the thing about that, if you recall it, we got it back to 3-3, and there was still time left. Remember, Jackie Oaker had a 1-on-1, and Martin Atkinson blew up for full time. And then you see Moyes, and I think it was Steve Round, you know, bailing onto the pitch, and I think they both got hefty fines for it. Yeah, that was memorable. And always shows, always states that they're, you know, in injury time of the game, you never know what can happen.
Remember last season with Alex Iwobi's putting 1-0 up with screaming, and just when I think about, I mean, this is such a long time ago now, but. Or it feels like it was such a long time ago. Actually, it wasn't that long ago. I think it was at the start of the three games. It was Man United, Spurs and Newcastle. They lost 3 in a row, didn't they? It just took the wind out of the sails. It would have been quite a good run, and they got the win against West Ham. They went 1-0 up. I think Onana robbed Casemiro of the ball. And Wobi he put it in and just think, And obviously, it all went downhill after that for a week or so. It was grim. Andy Gordon, a couple of years
ago. Oh, yeah.
Again, I know obviously the last few years haven't been very good, but I think that game came after the Burnley defeat in midweek. The Deitch, this side doesn't know how to win games anymore. And it was a game very much put Everton in a relegation battle. And then they went beat United. I mean, it took a massive deflection. But remember, that was a lunchtime kickoff, wasn't it?
Well, Saturday lunchtime. Tell you what, they talk about Pickford against Chelsea. Pickford was equally good against Man United in that game.
Yeah,
he pulled off about 3 or 4 brilliant saves.
Yeah.
As he usually does. Okay, well, we've just proved that we are not the Royal Blue dour gloomy podcast. We are the Royal Blue positive podcast. And so, basically, tell us your favourite and most memorable Everton goals against United in the comments. I'll read them out along with your name Also, yeah, as well, remember to give us a like on Facebook and subscribe to the Royal Blue YouTube channel. Show us your support. Any comments, any interaction will be greatly appreciated.
Can't believe I only mentioned 95.
95, yeah, the cup final.
Yeah.
It's a slightly different vibe, cup finals, though, I think it's Wembley's too big, isn't it?
Well, hopefully there's a couple. There's definitely a couple, so hopefully people will share their memories and, insights of what happened when we scored against United. Okay, back to the doom and gloom. Joe, you've wrote a really, really good takeover report earlier in the week. Me and Chris Beasley did a short pod on it we just discussed the ins and outs of it, had a look over your piece and stuff like that. But yeah, you're the man in the know and all that. Do you want to just give us a bit of insight? We know that 777 are having face-to-face meetings with the Premier League or meeting with the Premier League. We don't know when it is, but yeah, do you want to...
Yeah, well, that was scheduled for this week, and I think really we're into the sixth month now. Obviously, it's a process that they initially said they would hope would take 12 weeks. I think we all know that. I think there's a general acceptance that was ambitious now, because obviously we're into, I think, week 25 and this we're still no further along. So, yeah, I mean, it's obviously a concern, the fact that we haven't had a resolution on this. And the longer we go about resolution, the more uncertainty there is around Everton. It doesn't help a club that's generally quite unstable at the minute. Even before the takeover, uncertainty, you've got an interim board which has been in place since last summer. So in terms of who's making what decisions at the club and on what basis at the minute, and have been for some months, I mean, obviously that's a bit of a concern. I think what we are probably doing is moving, it might be inching, but moving towards an answer on this.
Yeah.
I think the fact that the Premier League, as part of their owners and directors test, had the power to call in the people that want to take over a club and have face-to-face meetings. Slightly surprised it hasn't happened before. The fact that it is happening, probably, it was very much a case of nobody believed that a decision would come immediately from that meeting. It's not like there was going to be a smoking gun produced and the Premier League was going to go to 777. What do you say to this? Or 777 would kind of come up with some miraculous document that shed light on everything that they were going to do and prove that they could do it. But obviously, it's a step forward in the process, and it's a step closer towards a breakthrough, whether that's good or bad, because it's a new development. So we'll see where it goes. I think that March feels like a time when this is going to start simmering. 777, they've been funding the club been putting money into the club ever since they agreed the takeover. I mean, it committed to about £200 million now. And they're not going to do that indefinitely. I think I've seen a few reports saying that they put their own March cutoff date on this. I understand that's not necessarily the case, but at the end of the month, their next loan would be due if they were to follow the same kind of course of action they have done so far. And I think there will be a genuine kind of review of the situation from 777's perspective when that deadline approaches, if an answer hasn't come from the Premier League at that point. That's not to say that they wouldn't continue the process. That's not to say that they wouldn't put more money in if they felt it was in their interest to do so. But I think there's probably a recognition from both sides now that this process needs to start drawing towards a conclusion. And I think that the attempt to have face-to-face meetings is probably a recognition of that. It'd be interesting to see where we go. But obviously, it's clearly an unhappy situation.
This meeting then, Gav, we don't know really when it's going to take place, but,
the schedule for this week.
This week, yeah.
So is it kind of now or never then, once this meeting's taken place?
Depends what they talk about in the meeting, what the outcome of it is. That's what I was saying last week. You get the impression the Premier League wants to push it through. It's only really, that's why it's gone on so long. I also think within this as well is the independent regulator's role comes into it, doesn't it? It's like the Premier League is dotting the I's and crossing the T's on everything. And I think as part of the owner's test, that's obviously an important part of their role. I think they're making sure that they've done everything properly and to the minutest detail on all applications. And I think that's also sort of the complicated matter with Everton, is obviously Everton's financial situation and 777 and not Jim Ratcliffe-Hardy, with all due respect. So I think that's complicated matters further. But I don't know are you surprised it's taking that long to have a face-to-face meeting, by the way?
Yeah, I think I am.
Yeah.
But, it's Premier League submitted new financial questions to 777 and let it go. And, you know, you kind of think, what could they be asking now that they haven't already been asking for 6 months? I'm sure it's a point, if 777's position is that they've provided all the information that they think's relevant and to a satisfactory level. Obviously, the Premier League disagree with that, otherwise they wouldn't be asking more questions. But it's hard to understand what the process is doing now if it's not going around in the same old circle. So at some point, someone's got to draw a conclusion to it. And I understand the Premier League can do that. They can end. It's not an indefinite process where 777 keep coming back to the table again and again and again until they run out of interest or patience or anything. So, yeah, we'll be interested. You said there, Gav, you feel like Premier League might be trying to give every opportunity to push this through.
Yeah.
I don't know if it might be the other way around, and they're almost hoping that they can do everything they can to avoid having to make a decision on this. Hope that, you know, 777... Because it's clearly a difficult position for the Premier League, because let's be honest, 777's track record and everything around them, giving them plenty of opportunities to talk about the positives, they won't address us or the fan groups or anything like that any more than what they did at the beginning of the process. Because, you know, they say out of respect for the process, that's the regulatory process that's ongoing. But obviously, I don't think it would prejudice that process to come out and say, well, this is what our plan is for the stadium, this is what our plan is for the team, this is where Everton will sit within this portfolio of clubs, this is how we plan to take the club forward, this is how much, you know, not necessarily how much of a transfer budget we're going to give you in the summer, but, you know, this is our three-step plan, and, you know, we're going to shore up this part of the club, and then we're going to move on to that. And things like, I do think that I think Everton fans deserve to be given more insights than necessarily they're being given at the minute. And I think really there are pros and cons with 777. Look, for all the aspersions that we might cast and the concerns around their financial background, and there are a lot of concerns, and it's too lengthy to go through on this. If you get the opportunity, go onto the Echo website and read my report. On the flip side, you say, well, they have given the club £200 million or committed to giving the club £200 million that... The club has, at the very least, found it that to them to be the most preferable source of that money. So they're getting the money from somewhere. I mean, if you listen to some conferences in America at the minute, it sounds like some of the people that put in some of the money into some of the affiliated companies of 777 are having second thoughts around that at the minute. Yeah. But, you know, it's a very, very complex web. But I think that it has probably been helpful for 777 and Farhad Moshiri that there's been so much other stuff around the club over the past 6 months that, you know, there's an exhaustion around probably a lot of people that are in and around the club, and a distraction because of things like points deduction and on the field matters as well. Because I do think that the minute what the fan base wants, or from the people that I speak to at the minute, people want clarity more than anything. They want to know what the situation is moving forward. They want answers to these questions so that people can start trying to think about what path the future might hold for Everton. But as much as clarity and certainty would be helpful, and this is the irony of the situation Everton find themselves in, having essentially been at war with the Premier League over PR, profit and sustainability and points deductions, and with another big case coming up, really now the future stability of the club lies in the Premier League doing a proper job on its owners and directors tests and doing genuine due diligence to work out who these people are, what their plans are, what their funding is, how they're going to fund them, and whether they can, whether or not they're suitable owners. The reality is that we are all reliant on the Premier League doing that job now, because they're probably the only people that can end this process. That's, I mean, obviously you've got Farhad Moshiri, 777, and the Premier League, and as long as Farhad Moshiri and 777 both want it to happen, then it rests with the Premier League. So we all need the Premier League to do a proper job and to be as, hopefully, to apply as much rigour to this process as it has to the Everton's finances in relation to profit and sustainability.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
What is the right decision, Gav? you spoke previously about, you know, your reluctance of 777 to take over.
Well, not reluctance in that, on face value, they don't appear to be, you know, the most ideal of owners, but nothing, doesn't that mean they can't do a job? I think the right decision, how long have you got? I think Joe's point is well made there, actually, in that I've got a view that actually the longer it goes on, the Premier League want to give it to 777. I think the alternative view is can also be to, it only shows what a complex process this is, that the Premier League, and I said this last week, they're in a difficult position. They've got to get the owners and directors' test correct. They don't necessarily want to give it to 7-7s for all those reasons we all know about. And they're just, at the same time, if they don't do that, they don't want to be seen to be stiffing Everton twice in terms of the commission and failing the owners and directors' test. So they are just waiting for 7-7-7 to sort of fail themselves, aren't they, to just walk away. So the Premier League can just take them down and pull the handle belt. Nothing to do with us. You know, they're the ones who've withdrawn here. You know, so, you know, Amy Raya at 777, not the Premier League. And I sort of get that because the Premier League are in a difficult position. I tell you what the wrong decision is the Premier League to give 777 the go-ahead just on the basis that it actually is convenient for the club in the short term. And it brings us a certain amount of short-term stability, even though in the back of the mind, I think that it's a bit of a risky appointment, this, if we do this, but we're just doing this just to, it'll look good for us and our relationship with Everton, perhaps, and Everton supporters or whatever, because we all know what the alternatives may be. I think that's the wrong decision. The right decision, I don't know at this stage, because we don't know what the conversations have been. We don't really know what 777 are bringing to the table other than what's in the public domain.
I mean, through this process, yeah. The Premier League have the opportunity to ask of 777 all the questions that likes of, myself as a journalist would like to ask them, what the Fan Advisory Board would like to ask them, what the Shareholders Association would ask them, and as part of it, demand a certain level of transparency and response and the quality of response. We can't make 777 do that. So you would hope that the Premier League is prepared to do it. I think there's so much uncertainty. It's like the points deduction stuff all over again. We're largely in uncharted territory as a fan base looking at this situation. And there are so many grey areas, because I think one of the things that I've been consistently saying throughout this process is that we don't really know is, and no one in the Premier League would on the record tell you this, but is how much the politics and the optics and the PR comes into it from a Premier League perspective. And is this a binary, are these suitable owners of a Premier League club, yes or no, that they've got to pass? Or is part of the question, are these potentially better owners than the ones Everton currently have? Because obviously that would lower the threshold, because the machinery era yeah. is coming to a very dismal end. It may well be that there may well be some voices in there that go, well, they might not be the ideal owners that we want to pass, but we might see them as better than what the current situation is. But then we end up in dangerous territory if that's the case. And that's a problem. I think that, the eyes of the world were looking at the Premier League. And I know that the panel that heard the case and delivered the points deduction was technically independent of the Premier League, but it was still, it was still a child of a Premier League process. And the eyes of the world were looking at that because it was going to set a precedent. And it feels like the eyes of the world again looking at the Premier League on this, because it is going to set a degree of precedent. Because, what do they come on? What is going to be the threshold for the future for people coming into the league to try and own clubs? There's a lot of weight on this decision. And on the one hand, they have the difficult relationship that they've got with Everton because of everything that's gone on. But they also have to think of the wider game, the other 19 Premier League clubs, the wider football pyramid, about who they're letting in and out of it. So, we just need to... the right decision is better than a quick one. But obviously, speed is out of the question now. It's been 6 months. But the right decision is better for Everton and for football in general in this country than the convenient decision, which I think is the point that Gavin's trying to make.
Yeah. Well, surely we can't afford to take on any more loans either.
Well, no, I mean, there is that problem.
That's just a major problem for me.
You're talking about a club now which is, best part of £500 million in debt to commercial lenders, as well as technically being about the same amount in debt to Fahad Mashiri. I mean, you would probably write that off as part of the sale. And obviously, if 777 were to get the go-ahead, the £200 million they've committed, rather than be, a loan would, and rather than be debt, would probably be converted into equity. So all of a sudden, if Mashiri writes off his portion and 7-7 essentially convert theirs into equity, yeah, that's part of the billion, comes down to several hundred million. Still not good, but you know, that helps. But obviously that's probably the big stumbling block with, if there was a way for anybody else to come in, or if 777 would be turned down, you know, they still have a big part to say in Everton's future, because Everton will owe them a lot of money. And if you look at, you know, Everton, as wonderful a club, as wonderful an institution as it is, and with some of the assets that it's got, you know, despite all that, for somebody else looking to come in and take over the club, there are some formidable, there's some formidable baggage to taking on the club, which could be problematic. So,
I mean, Gav, if we get a decision soon, and you know, 777 were to come in, take over, you could at least then say, well, at least we've got someone who's in control and going to be making decisions, whether that's, you know, primarily off-field decisions. But if it isn't to go through, we're literally back to square one. And where does that leave Mashiri then? Because obviously it kind of brings him back into play, in a sense that he's going to have to make some sort of decision with regard to the club's future, whether that is going to this, you know, so-called American consortium that are waiting in the wings to see if it falls through, or does he then just change his mind completely, do a U-turn and start to fund the club again, run the club again? You know, it just seems an absolute mess if this does not go through.
Well, absolutely. But Dan, I don't really do hear that Mashiri said that, haven't he? That he would fund the club as a going concern, but you just don't know, do you? You know, you don't know what Mashiri's financial position is and what his sort of objectives is as a businessman at the moment. And that is the $64,000 question, isn't it, really? What will happen if the deal doesn't go through? Joe, I know you touched upon this in your pieces. You know, what is... You've heard regularly over the last couple of months, oh, there are other interested parties. The problem with that is you would like those interested parties to make themselves known. If they've not made themselves known, is what is their, you know, how much do they want to get Everton just because they want to get Everton, or they just see something that's a really just cheap option and actually, you know, they see something that they get for next to nothing, rather than being a serious player as a football owner, football club owner. So that's the concern I've got. If there are other people out there, well, why have they not shown their hand now? Because there's been ample opportunity to. And what are your motives? Are your motives, you know, the same as what people allege about 777? It's all this uncertainty is damaging. You're seeing that, aren't you, now with the club, aren't you, in terms of the day-to-day decision-making, aren't you, really, about, you know, and Dice sort of touched upon this yesterday, is we've got an interim board in with interim people. Is, well, there's some big footballing decisions to take, isn't there, over the next 6 to 12 months about renewing contracts, that type of stuff. We've obviously got the Bramley Moore situation. There's a lot of big decisions to be taken, and you don't know who's going to take them, who's got the knowledge to take them, and who would, you know, how much would they say, well, I'm not going to say anything here because there could be somebody else within 2 months who'll come in and might have a completely different view. So for example, I'm not saying this, I'm picking on Dice because that's the obvious one. His contract is up for, when does his contract finish? Is it the end of next year? So over the next couple of months, you know, in normal circumstances, you'd be sitting down saying, listen, Sean, you know, let's have a look at your contract. You know, in the circumstances, we think you've done a fine job. We want to renew, you know, and that would be, you know, what we've seen so far, that would be an understandable decision. But, you know, the long history of football shows you, in a situation like Everton, a new owner might come in, new ideas, and say, well, you renewed that contract, we don't want that person. We want to bring our own person in. And I've seen, you know, the classic example there was when we sacked, you know, not sacked, that was a Freudian slip there, because the rumours that he was going to get the ball. When Howard went in 93, because I think Howard thought, you know, when he resigned in 93, but that was on the cusp of the Peter Johnson era. And I think he thought that actually a new owner's going to come in and he's not going to want me as manager. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to walk now to save them, save the embarrassment of getting sacked. And I think there's an element to that here. I think with the new owner on on the horizon, hopefully, is what that means for the manager and the big decision around the manager. And then that also then means big decisions around the players as well. And it'll just be interesting to see how that plays out, because you know there's other players who've got contracts up for renew. You may want to renew them, you may not, or you might want to sell players, might need in the summer.
I mean, the decision for the next few months, or one of the main decisions for the next few months, it would be you start to build the squad that you want to take you into that first game at the new stadium. Do you want DCL there? Do you want so many others? Because obviously their contracts, a lot of these contracts run out in just over a year, and it's obviously once you enter the last year of your contract, your value goes down quite considerably as well. So, so you need people making sensible decisions from a profit and sustainability point of view about, who is available for sale and who you want to renew and things like that. That forward planning, and obviously one of the reasons that they're in the mess that they're in at the minute is because of a lack of sensible forward planning. Or big decisions need to be made for 18 months' time now. Obviously, you need a bit of stability. But again, I think that we'd be naive if you were to look at the clubs that 777 has in its portfolio. Again, the article runs through it, but I mean, there are several of those clubs have had transfer bans for late payments for fees. One has had a points deduction, albeit last season. Standard at the moment.
Not new to us, that joke.
Standard.
Yeah.
Standard Liège of being late in playing their players for the last 3 months in a row. Now, 777 will say that their track record is they take over distressed assets. They take over big football clubs with lots of problems because they can get them. Yeah, they believe they can, get them on cheaper, but they can also turn them around, and there will always be an overhang of the old problems. And we can appreciate this with Everton. Anybody that takes over Everton now will be dealing with the legacy of the decisions under the Moshiri era for a long time. So, they'll say that they put some of the issues down to administrative errors. And, what part of what I was doing with that story is putting everything out there for people to judge what their own want to say. They will say that, well, these clubs have been struggling off the pitch. A lot of that is because of struggles off the pitch as well. And this is all stuff that we need to come in and remedial action and sort. It's a gradual process and, it's taking time. Others might say, there's an awful lot of these things happening across the portfolio. So, what's going on, and how much can, their viability as football club owners be trusted? Other side, again, you look at the article. Some of those clubs have improved and taken a little bit of time around, but improved on the football pitch. Again, that's a very small snapshot. We know what difference a run of victories can make, or seasons that have only just started. Vasco da Gama got promoted. They stayed up, set up on the last day of the season. You couldn't, is that good? Is it bad? Well, it was progress, I suppose. Genoa, at that point deduction last season, they still got promoted, and it looked like they're going to stay up this season. Quite, a very safe mid-table Serie A side, which is good. That's their kind of the team that they hold up as the example. And I haven't had the chance to look at this properly, but seen some positive reports about their latest accounts in the Italian media, but I haven't had the chance to check them out yet properly and see what's that going on. There's just so much around 777, and there's no doubt there are red flags. The question is, how many red flags are too many red flags? And I think that's the question the Premier League are probably looking at the moment. But for us, it's obviously a really complicated situation for a club that is so precious and so dear to so many. So we're going to just have to wait and see. But the due diligence needs to be done. They need to be held, accountable for what their plans are going to be. And, whether they can or not, we'll probably start to find out in the coming... I think we'll probably... I don't know if we'll find out this month, but I feel like some big decisions should be made and this month. Probably rephrase this. The next three weeks is huge for Everton Football Club, and it's biggest for the understanding of people like ourselves and fans as to where the club is truly at. Because in the next 3 weeks, the club will have to publish its accounts for the season that ended last summer. That's the accounts where we know we're expecting losses, because it's the only way that Everton could have got to a position where the Premier League could accuse them of breaching PSR for a second consecutive season. So we know from the outset it looks like it's going to be a negative. how big a negative is going to be a really interesting question, because that will determine, the club's already under an allegation of PSR for that. So, yeah, we'll see how strong the Premier League's case is on that. We'll see how strong some of Evans' potential defences against that. Are they, you know, we think, as we discussed last week, that the trend is going to be negative and it's going to be a bigger loss than the year before from a PSR perspective once the allowances are reduced. Well, are there positive trends? Are there negative trends? Are there mitigating circumstances that we can see? Obviously, it'll be slightly different this time with the Russia argument, was slightly different because Evan will be able to show it'll be the first year where they've suspended and there's no money coming from USM, and they'll be able to evidence the consequences of a proactive decision that the club took and decided to take, that I think we would all agree was probably the right one in suspending those deals before they were made to, because USM was sanctioned sometime after that. So we will see a lot of that. We'll see what the accountants say about the club as a going concern. We'll get a true picture, I think, really, as to what the running costs are, how things have been coming down, the wage bill, where the club would find itself if it wasn't getting the money from 777. We would also find out in the next few weeks whether or not 777 will remain committed for another month, because their next loan will be due at the end of the month. As I said, I think they're probably going to review the situation. Not saying they're going to pull a plug by any stretch of the imagination, but they will at least have to consider it again. We will probably this month have the second PSR case. It's got to be concluded by April the 8th, and obviously Forest are on the same timeline as Everton. So I don't, although it will be separate commissions that over separate, well, I'm assuming it'll be separate panels. It might be the same panel over here. Might be a best thing for consistency.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
a difficult one.
Yeah.
But I'd be surprised if the two cases ran at the same time. So one of them would have to start in March at the very least, for them to both, they have to be under the Premier League's 12-week timetable, finished by Monday, the April the 8th. Obviously, we wouldn't probably hear the outcome of them by that point, but the arguments would have been had. So this is a really, really and obviously you then go on the pitch, and like, granted, after tomorrow, Everton don't play for some time, but some of the rivals do. I think Luton have quite a few games in this little period, so we'll probably have a little bit of an indication as to where Everton are in the relegation battle for when the April fixtures come along, because obviously those April fixtures start at Bournemouth and at Newcastle, and yeah, that's a tough return. Having a better away from home, they could very legitimately beat both sides and get six points from that. But they could also be very difficult games as well. And Everton over the Easter break, it's going to be interesting. So we will learn a lot over the next 3 weeks, and a lot of a good chunk of the grey areas of the unknowns that we don't know at the minute will become the information will be out in the public for us to try. And interpret. So, this will be a month in. It's a big month for the club. It's a big month for us. And it's probably a month in which a lot of, say, the uncertainty will turn to answers, and we'll get a true reflection of where the club is at, certainly financially.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
Go on, Gab, you going to jump in there?
No, I was going to say, it's just by, an unfortunate coincidence of time, and that 3-week period Joe was talking about, we haven't got a game. So we've got, imagine all that new space then for that 3-week period. There's not going to be matters on the pitch. Okay, there's a bit of a training camp and stuff. But, that in terms of the news cycle, there's a vacuum there to fill, isn't it?
God, so can you imagine how gloomy and dire the podcast are going to be?
I don't know. Could be some other stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
Some pleasant surprise. Yeah. There
could be other stuff.
Points to concern. Yeah, but we don't know if it's going to be out there. Yeah, we don't know the base. The club initially disputed to some extent the second breach thing. We might see a strong case in defence emerge from that. We don't know, and to some extent we have to give the benefit of the doubt until we do. So, hopefully we'll see Jarrod Branthwaite get his first senior England call up, and maybe there'll be a few.
Our rivals could lose all their games so there's, it's not necessarily a negative thing. I'm just thinking of the coverage, both yourselves, obviously, you need to provide you know, up-to-date news and nationally. It's just going to be about off the pitch stuff, isn't it, with Everton? Which,
I mean, having games hasn't been a great help to all that in the last two and a half months. Has
it? No, absolutely, But I would say, just use the word distraction. I don't know, but it doesn't help. But I think we'll know a lot more clearer. We'll have a lot more clearer picture by the end of March about where we're heading on and off the pitch, hopefully. And it's all hoping it's a positive track, really.
Yeah. So big month. Big couple of weeks, so please follow us on our website and YouTube and Facebook and subscribe. And Joe, Chris, the lads, and myself, Gav, will be here every step of the way. Should we talk about United? Gav, go on. I'll start with you first. So on this one, you going? You're going to be in?
I'm going. Yeah. I've not been to Old Trafford for many years, a long time ago. So I'm going tomorrow. I'm looking forward to it. 12:30 kickoff. Old Trafford has probably changed since the last time I went there.
I don't think it's changed that much.
No, well, I was just talking to...
Part of Ratcliffe's problem.
Yeah. But it's that long ago since I've been. But yeah, it's still, you know, you can see why they want to have a new stadium. It's still one of the great grounds to go to, Old Trafford. Certainly when I was going away from home, it was probably the away game I looked forward to the most, because it was always a great atmosphere, big ground, only a mile down the... And only an hour down the road, so it was the away game I always look forward to the most, and I look forward to tomorrow. And there's two clubs who are probably on the pitch are probably in similar positions, aren't they? Man United were sort of got themselves into a decentish position, but they've lost two. We're obviously looking for a win, which I think we can certainly get a result there. I was just looking at. Pay a lot of attention to the stats, but it was noticeable that and Dice spoke about this at length yesterday. We've had more shots than Man United this season. Yeah. That, you know, I think we've had 20 more shots than them. We've created a third more big chances, whatever you define a big chance. Yet they're 16th, 17th, they're sixth. And that speaks volumes for some of the problems that have infected us, doesn't it, really, on the pitch, is our lack of potency up front. And that just brought that into perspective for me. About why we are where we are. Yes, on the occasions we've not defended well, like last Saturday. But wow, if we'd have converted a lot of our chances, you know, the chances we would have expected to finish, we could be in a different position to where we are at the moment. And I think, though, you can't criticise Dice there. I could understand some of his frustrations, really, with our lack of finishing ability at key moments during the game, and you saw that. In spades last Saturday, didn't you, against West Ham?
I mean, you mentioned the stats there. Do you take much from, you know, the Dice likes to talk about XG and, you know, Everton have underperformed, you know, through their expected goals told. Do you take much from that?
You can say over a long period of time, if you don't do it, there's obviously an issue there of quality, I suppose. But at the same time, you know, you do think on the balance of probabilities, not all. So, see, we say we're minus 12 against where we should be in terms of goals. Just like 4 out of them 12 might have made a big difference on occasions. And we can all make big chances. Last, you know, see McNeil last week when it's 1-0. You know, that's just one. Yeah. That could have given us 3 points rather than losing 3 points. So, it does. I think we're not. Perhaps you shouldn't be 12 goals better off where you should be, but even just a couple here and there might have made the difference. And I think he can be understood that he's probably got a point when he says that. Over a longer period of time, it probably does paint a picture about the quality of some of the players we've got. But also sometimes, you know, I think what's really hurting the team, and we spoke about this before Christmas when he saw that long run of fixtures in December, and we've got like a really threadbare squad, and we did really well, didn't we, up until the last week or two before Christmas. At some point, that's going to catch up with you, isn't it, really? And you suspect that it's caught up with us having to play. You know, do my bike, you know, weekly stats. I just copy the previous teams to see the previous week into my spreadsheet into the last fixture, because, you know, it's going to be the same team every week, and sometimes that's not healthy. And the lack of options off the bench, though I think he should use what options he's got more effectively. I think that's hurting us. I think there's a few players out there who are obviously fatigued, you know, and I think that when you're in good scoring positions, that can affect you. And I think there are, dare I say, mitigating factors have been used many times by Everton this season. And I think that's a mitigating factor for Dyche in terms of the resources had available to him, you know, certainly just before Christmas. I think that's affected our performances. And, you know, when we went to the Man United game in November, us Man United and Liverpool had the best records in the country over the previous 10 games. You know,
just on the XG, do you think, does Dyche use it as a bit of an excuse to say, like, not that he's like,
yeah,
he's obviously responsible, but the fact that we have got a good XG and we're up to, you know, I think we're eighth out of the 20 teams for XG. Is it easy for him to say, well, we're getting the players in these positions, we're creating the chances, but they're the ones that are not finishing it? No, I get that. Yeah, he's right in the sense that he's not the one scoring the goals.
Yeah.
He's maybe not the one even, you know, making the defensive individual error. But at the end of the day, like, the buck does stop with the manager, doesn't it? You know, it is the responsibility of the manager to get these players to be scoring goals.
He puts the players out and selects the team and, you know, chooses the tactics. And the buck obviously stops with him. At the same time, once those players go across the white line, your influence is diminished somewhat, isn't it, really? And you are, you know, that's why the manager can be the worst, you know, they're well paid for it now, can be the worst job in football. It's like a lot of stuff that really important stuff is outside your control. And so I get that, that he's responsible, but he must say what little head he's got left out on occasions where, you know, where we should finish chances. I mean, those two home games at the start of the season, Fulham and Wolves game. You know, and we have been unlucky that a few goalkeepers have had their best game of their career. I believe Areola, one of the leading football websites who does analyse performance, it was the best goalkeeping performance of the season by anybody at Goodison last week. So,
and then the next two is youscored.com, and then the next two best performances by a goalkeeper this season were also keepers at Goodison.
So I'd rather have it like that than actually goalkeepers have their worst performance, but we still didn't score. So I do get what he's saying. At the same time, I do understand that he ultimately is the person responsible, and the buck stops with him. And you would hope that in the next week, like before Christmas, we are a little bit more potent in front of goal, because we beat Newcastle 3, it was a 3-0, you know, a couple of good results away from home. So, that hopefully that will change. The concern I've got at the moment is defensively we're looking a little bit, not wouldn't say ragged, but we're switching off at key moments. We switched off twice last week against West Ham. The third goal is just a gimme, really, because it's on the break. We switched off against Brighton to a degree. And that's the concern I've got, because for a long period of this season, we've been, what I'll say, behind Man City and Liverpool in terms of defence. And we're now just looking a little bit ragged. And again, that could be down to fatigue as well, couldn't it? You know, and the right-back position is something that needs looking at. That hasn't helped us. But, you know, hopefully, you know, tomorrow, I think there's absolutely no reason at all tomorrow that we can't get a result. Because, I'll tell you why, pressure tomorrow, it's on United. Yeah. It's not on us. It's on Ten Hag. He's had two bad defeats. You know, so all the game tomorrow is on them. And that will make a change for us, because it's last few weeks in the game, it's been on us, hasn't it? So that just changes the mood a little bit tomorrow, I think, in the dressing room.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
Well, it was suggesting in the media this week that, you know, Ten Hag's three games away from the sack. But just staying with Dyche, Joe, you know, he's fast approaching an unwanted Premier League record, unfortunately, which will be... It's a record that dates back to August to October 1994. So it would be the longest Premier League winless streak.
What's the record at the
moment? 12 matches.
He's at 10 with the next three being... Man United away, Bournemouth away, Newcastle away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, we don't win at Old Trafford anyway. So it's not ideal, is it? You know, and for all the good that he has done and the position that we find ourselves in, regardless of any points deduction or not, this run that we're on, we're absolutely stuck in a rut. And we, you know, I believe it was Mike Walker who was part of that And obviously, John Royal took over at some point during that period. But it is. I'm not advocating for us to sack Dyche. I'm absolutely not. But it would be the pressure to go to those 12 and beyond. Mm-hmm. You would start questioning things a little bit, wouldn't you? Well, I would anyway. Would you do the same? Sorry.
I think context is important.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that many teams would have gone on a run as bad as this, in theory, in terms of a winless streak, but picked up as many points as they have. They have drawn quite a few games, with the exception of Wolves. They've been in all the games as well, haven't they? So that helps. Like, they're not a side. They are a side that's looking a little bit ragged at the minute. That's probably a bit harsh. I think just a little bit knackered at the minute. Mm. There are a lot of players that have played a lot of minutes and have been required to do. So even that they're required to play lots of games is the full 90 minutes plus 5, 6, 7 every time. And when you look at, I know there's been a lot of talk about McNeil and Harrison recently. They both had bad injuries to start the season with, and they've had no let up. James Gardner, who's only a young player, who's been one ever present there, he had to carry that midfield over a difficult January. You know, Fulham is your only fit central midfielder around. Look, I mean, you can't go that long without being under some pressure. But one, I think that the results, it's like when Lampard finished with 8 without a win, and haven't lost a lot of those games. They haven't quite lost as many in this run. They've created a lot of chances. Talk about XG and things like that. They have. I think it'd be more worrying if we're in a situation, if everyone were losing every game 2-3 by 2-3-4 goals and not creating any chances, then that'd be a lot different to Everton drawing every game and, you know, drawing most games and creating the chances to win and not taking them. And also the context in which Everton sit in terms of the league, obviously. Normally at this point you'd be somewhere near a relegation battle. Everton are, but even then, the only reason that they're anywhere near a relegation battle is because they've got a 6-point deduction. You can't fairly judge the bad run now without also looking back to the good run that took Everton onto the points tally that they should have. And, you know, I think the fairest way to judge Dyche at this present moment in time is to compare him with where Everton were this time in the last two seasons, and really without an unprecedented points deduction, still unprecedented, even if it's 6, not 10. Really, if without that, we'd be looking at, say, these missed chances, this bad run's costing Everton a tilt at Europe, not potentially Premier League. And you think Everton's club's been through on and off the pitch, what he's had to deal with, the squad that he's inherited, which is still a mess, hasn't had the resources to address it properly. I know Everton have signed players under his watch, but you know, all those players, all those deals that have been done have come within a certain backdrop. You know, it's one thing saying, you know, people might have issues with Beto and his finishing and the amount of money that's been committed to him. It's, well, they needed a striker. The Mope debacle last season showed they needed a striker that could at least mimic to some extent what Dominic Calvert-Lewin did. And they needed one that would cost them nothing up front. So, I mean, your pool drops. The options drops quite considerably at that point. So you know, but yeah, of course you'd be under pressure. And if that 10 stretches to 13, it would only take Luton to win one of those games during that period, and all of a sudden it's 2 points from a relegation zone with another points deduction potentially looming, and all of a sudden you start to think, again. But we look back, even if it got to that point, one, you'd still probably have a decent case to say. I mean, at that point, you'd probably start to start question a bit more, but you come back to two things. One, who'd be better out there? And two, who really makes the decisions? Because the off-the-pitch stuff hasn't been sorted out. Obviously, we know Falwell sits above Dyche, but who's Falwell reporting to at the minute, really? And what sway do they have? And you know, you look at that boardroom, it's not full of footballing minds, is it? So yeah, that's I'm not saying it necessarily was before either, but there are a lot of situations that there are a lot of conversations I hope we don't end up having, and you're right to point them out as a possibility. But look, I think that all we can do at the moment is look at the job that Deitch has done and to a certain extent farewell and say within the context in which they're operating, this club, this football team and that squad has made a lot of progress this season. Whether it can finish off the job remains to be seen. But everything that they've, when you look at their job as a whole, I think they deserve the benefit of the doubt to carry on going. And I have a degree of sympathy for Deitch because, you know, we talk about the XG and the missed chances. I can remember saying this after Fulham and Wolves, and his squad's only got weaker since then with the players that have departed. He likes of you, Alex Iwobi, Shadamari Gray's. Really, I look at that and I think it's a miracle. It surprises me that he's managing to put out a team there that is actually staying in games as long as they are and creating as many chances. All right, they're not finishing a lot of them, but I'm actually surprised with the options he's got that they're actually getting that far. You know, so at the end of the day, you can't. It's him. It's up to him to put out the best team that he thinks he can put out to get positive results and the best tactics to get them. And I mean, at the minute, he's getting 80% of the way there. He's getting to a situation wherever, and they're getting good chances in the box, and he can't finish them, and are in games long enough for them to be able to keep the opposition out and get good results. And then, as we've seen in recent weeks, there's just a switch off. Yeah. He can't, obviously, personnel changes and what he says to the players, and that does have an impact, but it's not like he's got a plethora of options to choose from. To freshen things up. He can't put the ball in the back of the net, and he can't make sure that the defence has been switched on for 88 minutes, stays switched on in the 89th, and that's difficult. I think the right backs, the most obvious place to look at to try and influence a little bit of a change is probably right back. You know, Ben Godfrey has done a good job in some circumstances. We probably have to look at whether or not Everton need a little bit more attacking intent there, and at what point that comes into play. And also, not saying it's an easy job, but Lewis Dunk's header, it was Ben Godfrey that was marking him, and Kurt Zouma's header, it was Ben Godfrey that's marking him. One or two things has to happen there. Either Godfrey, obviously the problem is the ball coming in the first place, that there are lots of things that go wrong before. Godfrey is very much the last line of that. One or two things needs to happen. Either Godfrey needs to put his arm in and just make sure that these stay switched on, and make sure that they're not getting free headers, which they have been in the fence essentially recently. Or Deitch needs to say, if I still believe that Godfrey's right thing for the team, maybe not have a situation where he's the one that's marking the most dangerous player from an opposition set piece time and time again. And that's where it comes on to Deitch.
Yeah,
if Godfrey, say for. If Everton go to Old Trafford tomorrow and it's 0-0 and in the 88th minute, Scott McTominay scores a header and it's Godfrey that's on him, tomorrow that's on Deitch, not Godfrey.
Yeah, we'll be 3-0 up at that stage, so don't worry about it. Yeah.
Okay, we've been talking for an hour and there's so much I still want to ask, but I'm not going to be able to, so let's just get to some of the comments before we come on to prediction and team selection, and then we'll finish off. So, Gav, Emma EFC on YouTube, regular contributor to the question, says, when was the last time he set us up to win, not lose, is his philosophy, obviously?
I think you've got to look at the resources you've got available to you here, haven't you? We haven't got an 11 that we can put out that's full of flair, quality midfielders, speedy wingers, Premier League proven strikers, and with all due respect to DCL, that may not be the case at the moment. So he would argue he hasn't got the resources to go out and win. He to go out and win a game from the off. But at the same time, he has set up the team where it can win, and has won. He won 8 games in the first. Well, he said the first 16 was or something like that. So I would query whether, if you go outside, say, dare I say, the top 5 or 6 clubs in the Premier League, I wonder how many of those clubs on any given day set out their team to win. I think a lot of football now is, as we well know, is don't have the ball. There's exceptions to that, Brighton being one of them. But I think that football has changed. I think you set up to win by not setting up to win, by letting them, the opposition, play, and then you counter them and, you know, let them have 50-60% possession. So I think there's two things going on there. A, modern football, and B the lack of resource that Dice has, you know, got, as Joe has, you know, has pointed out there. Could we be doing more? Yeah, I think there's been games this season we could have done more. Arsenal at home would be definitely one of them, where we just let the opposition dictate. But last week, did you have more possession than West Ham?
We did,
yeah. Okay, a team that...
It's a weird kind of conflict.
Good question, by the way. I think it's a good question.
It's a great question, and it's something kind of intuitive in the way that almost... For Dyche to give... Everton having the best chance to win... of a win means conceding most possession of this group of players. So it's a strange one. But I think it's a great question. And I would flip it around a little bit. I think Dyche always sets out his teams. I think if you were to ask Dyche, he would always say he sets out his teams to win, that he wants to win games. We can have our own kind of thoughts on that, interpretations of the tactics. I would flip it around and say the first time that I think that we saw Dyche set out a team not to lose was Palace a couple of weeks ago when Onana was on the bench. Godfrey was still right back. And I think that Ashley Young was
the Monday one
on the right into the Harris. So Harrison and Onana were on the bench. That felt like, for me, the first time where it was almost like you were keeping something in reserve in from Everton as an attacking threat. And I felt that, to me, when I look back, it feels like the first time I think Dyche just perhaps set out a team not to lose for whatever reason. And I think that what happened on that night shows it could be a problem if he continues that going forward. It's a difficult one going to Old Trafford, Bournemouth and Newcastle, because points will all be good results and points will help Everton, you know, especially, you know, with, say, other teams are going to find it difficult to pick up points from some of the games that they've got. So not getting beat is still very, very valuable for Everton for a number of reasons. But yeah, that was the first one where I felt like it was he took a particularly defensive mindset to a game, and it's going to be interesting to see what he does in April if Everton find themselves caught in a genuine relegation battle. If they carry on losing games and not winning games, and we see something of a resurgence from the teams beneath, you know, and Luton, look, they're fighting every game, but do they have the quality to win a lot? Probably not. Forest are a weird side. They have, you know, at the back they're not the best, but going forward they do have goals in them, so you don't know what's going to happen. Brentford are a strange one because they've just had so many injuries and absences this season that, you know, it feels like Thomas Frank with his full strength side gets that Brentford side away from danger, especially knowing that Forest and Everton are probably going to have more points deductions. But they're also on a bad run and need to change things around. So, but yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see Dyche's approach to some of those games, because if Everton find themselves hovering 2 or 3 points above a relegation zone, even more so if Forest are above them, then come those games mid-April onwards, all of a sudden it'll become, knowing with some of the games to come as well, you know, Chelsea away, Liverpool at home, Arsenal away, then all of a sudden the onus might come on Everton to go, actually, we need to win these games rather than draw them.
And that's where the problem happens. It'll be really interesting to see what he does and how he thinks...
containment and counter attack is the best way, or whoever tries to be a bit more proactive going forward. It's interesting.
I think possibly Emma's question there is tilted towards set out to dominate, which is a slightly different, twist on the question, but it's a good question. Managers have the natural styles. I mean, that's what Moyes is getting stick for at West Ham. He's got some really good players, but Moyes would never set a team out to dominate and win a game. He's always been slightly more cautious, and there's nothing wrong with that as a manager. Every manager's got their style that they have from the day they step into the dugout.
It's interesting because obviously the two managers probably get the most stick for their approach. They probably haven't had the most successful seasons this season. What's on the pitch? You know, Moyes has got West Ham still in Europe and currently seventh in the European places. you know, despite fighting, you know, despite £1 billion spending Chelsea around them and Brighton for all the plaudits they get and Wolves for the good season they're having. And Everton, as I say, if you add those 6 points back on, are a team that have taken the relegation fight to the last week of the season for two seasons in a row, lost players and not been able to spend money over the last, you know, over the summer transfer window, and didn't spend anything in January, and really should just be consolidated, you know, on the pitch in mid-table and feeling hard done by that they're not looking at Europe because they can't score their chances rather than looking nervously over their shoulder.
Yeah, so just on Emma's question and point, and you know, just because you're a counter-attacking team, and I don't necessarily think we are a counter-attacking team, even though we
haven't got pace up. No, we need pace to be counter-attacking.
In a way, we kind of do set up to be a counter-attacking team because we don't have possession of the ball.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So counter-attacking teams, I don't know, I'm trying to think off the top of my head who are the best counter-attacking teams in the world. Just maybe Bayern used to be like a really fantastic counter-attacking team. They don't start that game thinking we're not going out attacking here. It's just their style of play that suits them better. Yeah. We definitely, I think, the way Sean Dyche sets up is geared to be more penetrable in terms of attacking as a counter-attacking team, but we don't counter-attack. We don't. Because we can't. No,
it's to be more effective in the opposition third. So when the ball's in the opposition third, to be more effective than they are, really. And that's why we've scored so many goals from set pieces, isn't it, really? It's making best use of the resources available to you.
We can, you know, talk about XG and
yeah.
We put in. The one thing that Dyche's team does is create lots of chances. It's setting up a team with all the issues that it's got, and it's creating lots of chances. So
just one final point on that. It's really good question that you could fill a podcast with is, I watched how Kendall, Everton's greatest ever manager, perhaps I'd argue that Harry Katsic would run him close. I saw virtually every Everton away game in the mid-80s when Howard, we had one of our greatest teams, if not the greatest team. And I can tell you for one, Howard did not set them up away from home to win matches in terms of dominate games. His thing was sit deep, contain, you know, keep it at 0-0 for as long as possible. Then the last 20 minutes or 30 minutes, use your extra quality to win the match. And that's invariably what we did. But he never set out to dominate from the start. Liverpool in the heyday under Bob Paisley, he never dominated away games. They were to contain. Used it because when they had the back pass there, it's just, what's Liverpool and Everton games and the really great teams, the 80s? Away from home, first 60, 70 minutes, see how many times the ball's passed back to the goalkeeper just to take the sting out of the game. They didn't set out to win the game from the off. They set out to dominate. They set out to get a result, which is a slightly different thing. And Dyche, I'm not comparing Dyche to Kendall, obviously, but Dyche is making the best use of resources and the mindset of the team to try and win. But it's a good question.
No, it's a really interesting point, and I think it's one that a lot of Evertonians have their opinion on and back and forth debate. So I'm going to finish off I'm going to bash out some questions or some of the comments really quick. So we asked at the start of the pod to submit your most memorable Everton goal against United. To be honest, there's not been many submitted. Mark from YouTube has said the Bob Lashford goal cross from Thomas against Coventry. I don't think Mark's quite understood the question there. But, and Loftus on Facebook says, this is a good one, this Duncan when he hit it on the turn. I think that was at Old Trafford.
Old Trafford 96,
Remember that one? Yeah, and they're the only two that we've had so far. So, other comments? Go on.
There's one thing, just going off on a complete and utter tangent. That game against Coventry in 77 was in the news this week. Okay. If you're on Twitter, you know Kai Havertz scored the 150,000th top-flight goal on Monday against Sheffield United. Well, for years, it was thought that the 100,000th top-flight goal was scored in that game, the Everton-Coventry game by Jim Pearson in 1977. It now transpires, it wasn't. It was actually scored by Wood on the same afternoon, 8 minutes later, by one only Joe Royal, playing for Bristol City.
Wow, that's why you are there. That's why you're the statistician, Gav. That's what it is.
Now, somebody else on Twitter flagged it, but his double-checking is correct in the news this week, that game.
Okay, Shane on Facebook says, lads, do we stick with Dyche? I mean, based on what you've said.
Absolutely.
Saying that. Graveson on YouTube, I assume it's not the Thomas Graveson, says, if 777 take over, we'll do a Leeds and drop for decades.
There's an uncertain future, whatever happens next at Everton. And, you know, I think it's right that people are concerned, and I think it's right that the Premier League, or it's right that the Premier League do proper due diligence on these people. I hope that they are.
Yeah. Two Wheel, who's on YouTube, says Tarkowski managed to say twice in a recent interview that the manager set us up to play in a certain way. I wondered if that was a criticism. What do you think?
Chris, I can't see James, with all this history of being managed by Dyche, would publicly criticise the manager. He's saying there what we're just saying in response to Emma's question, isn't it? It's set up in a certain way to contain, and then the fact when you get the ball in the final third of the pitch, be effective, and that's playing in a certain way, isn't it?
Okay, well, we're deep into injury time now. So, predictions. We always got to finish on predictions. Joe?
2-1 Everton.
Wow.
But why not? Yeah, why not? No. Why not? They United are on. They're going to go on the pitch tomorrow, a fighting team tomorrow. United went 3-0. Yeah. I'm going to go with my normal bottle job, by the way, which I got right the other week against Brighton. 1-1 I said. I wasn't exactly jumping up when Dunk scored, by the way. I'm going to go with my normal bottle job 1-1. I think that's eminently achievable.
Every time I've been positive, we don't win. I mean, I was positive for the West Ham game, but I just knew in the back of my mind that it was either going to be a draw or a loss.
Come on, one point about the West Ham game last week, a good point made to me after the game by one of the lads I was with, is Everton fans have been saying for ages, and this is like, I really get this frustratingly, is we've been waiting for ages to get being disadvantaged, not having somebody sent off against us and not getting a penalty. Last two games, both things have happened, and we've not taken advantage in either game. And I think that was a really, really good point that we have shot ourselves in the foot on occasions.
Well, that has been the most frustrating point from the past two games. You've obviously brought it up there, without a doubt, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of one of the things I was writing after the game last weekend, that for so much of the season, it's felt like the world's been against Everton, and with some legitimacy. Last two or three weeks, Palace, the manager situation, best four players out injured, bad form, Brighton down to 10 men, 1-0 up going into stoppage time. And last week with a penalty, things have gone Everton's way the last 3 weeks. They haven't taken advantage. They had 9 points rather than 2 from them. Then they'd be
quite safe.
That's it. All right.
Great.
I'm going to go reverse psychology, 2-0 to Manchester United.
What?
No, but we'll just, reverse psychology. Reverse psychology. That's what it is. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, you can't really lose at that one, can you, really?
No, because I'll be delighted if we win.
Yeah, and if you get beat, I told you so. If it's a draw... We don't know, really. Yeah, we might, one all.
Okay, well, that's all for today's show.
I like my... you started this by saying we're not the gloomy podcast, and you've ended up with that.
It's reverse psychology. Reverse psychology.
You know, next time, you should say before we come on here, Ian, I've got a question for you, by the way. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but I'm going to put you under pressure.
Okay.
Great.
Go for it. Thanks for today. Guys, please remember, to those listening, watching on YouTube, Facebook, subscribe to the Royal Blue YouTube channel, follow us on Facebook, EFC Liverpool Echo. I've been Ian Crowell, joined by Joe Thomas and Gav Buckland, and this has been the Royal Blue Podcast.
You've been listening to the Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.